This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, June 9, 2003. I'm Deepa Fernandez. As three Palestinian groups join together in an attack on the Israeli military, the American media is painting Ariel Sharon as the peacenik. The US military is failing to disarm Iraqis who say they need weapons to defend themselves against rising crime and insecurity. And we go to Toxic Town, Anniston, Alabama, where residents are fighting back against decades of military and corporate toxic pollution. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Andrew Stelzer with these headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Bush administration officials are maintaining the president's position concerning Iraq's alleged hoarding of chemical and biological weapons, yet Department of Defense documents continue to rebuke these arguments. James Cullum reports from Washington.
The Defense Intelligence Agency says Iraq probably had chemical and biological weapons, but that there was no definite proof. In a two-page report shown to Congress that will shortly be declassified and made public, the DIA says that there was also no evidence to show Saddam Hussein as a threat to U.S. national security. President Bush, in a cabinet meeting, insisted that the U.S. does not have a credibility problem with its intelligence sources and that the sole purpose for the invasion was Iraq's disarmament. Secretary of State Colin Powell defended his own credibility by saying that evidence of Iraq's weapon systems will be found. But as U.S. searches return empty-handed, the question grows. Who to believe, the Bush administration or the DIA? For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm James Cullum.
Burmese pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi was detained again last week, only a few days before the United Nations Special Envoy to Burma was scheduled to arrive in Rangoon. Now the UN envoy has announced he is leaving without seeing Suu Kyi. Dan Benton works with the Free Burma Coalition. He talked to Free Speech Radio News about this latest development.
The regime is continuing to thumb their nose at the international community. I don't think the regime wants to let him see Aung San Suu Kyi. And they knew he was scheduled to visit. They were probably prepared for this development when they decided to rearrest her. And she's also reported to be injured. We've heard rumors that she may be conducting a hunger strike and also refusing medical treatment. I think that's another reason they're trying to keep her out of sight, is the international outrage that will be provoked just by seeing her injured.
That was Dan Beaton of the Free Burma Coalition. After nearly 4 weeks of testimony in a federal court, a guilty verdict was reached today in the trial of INS agents accused of depriving a Mexican immigrant of his civil rights. This is the first time INS agents have been found guilty in a federal criminal court. Shannon Young files this report from Houston.
This morning, a Houston federal jury found three INS agents guilty of denying Mexican national Serafino Olvera his civil rights and of failure to render medical aid after sustaining injuries during a 2001 house raid in Bryan, Texas. Olvera's neck was broken as he was taken into custody. However, he was not taken to a hospital until several hours later, and only after the other witnesses from the raid had been deported back to Mexico. Olvera never recovered from his injuries and died 11 months later in a Houston hospital. Although the injuries sustained left him paralyzed from the neck down, he was pepper sprayed directly in the face by Agent Richard Gonzalez for refusing orders to move. Gonzalez was taken directly into custody following the trial after being found guilty of the additional count of improper use of pepper spray. The other agents are free on bond, pending a September 17th sentencing date. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Shannon Young in Houston.
KARN Radio in Little Rock, Arkansas, has been the focus of protests from Native Americans across the country for the past week after talk radio host Dave Ellswick offended natives with an off-the-cuff racial slur during his daily morning show. Jim Kent has more.
During a discussion about rude people, KARN's Dave Ellswick commented that, quote, "If they didn't act like little Indians, there would be no problem," end quote. Local listener and Menominee tribal member Kathy Bauer called KARN twice to complain, but was hung up on. An email to fellow Menominee and Wisconsin resident Richie Plass went out across the country the next day. KARN was soon flooded with complaints. Plass says he also received a hostile response when he called and spoke to Ellswick's producer.
"Look, dude," he said, "I don't really know who you are, and I can't believe you're calling." He says, "So I tell you what," he says, "why don't you just go home and smoke your peace pipe and have a nice day," and then he hung up.
Station manager Neil Gladner didn't offer a comment on behalf of the station, but says Dave Ellswick did apologize during his Thursday show. Bauer says she listened to the entire show that day, but heard no apology. For Free Speech Radio, I'm Jim Kent.
The Environmental Protection Agency's Office of Enforcement and Compliance has reported that a fourth of the nation's water treatment facilities are in violation of pollution standards, and that these facilities are not being fined by the EPA. Miranda Dunn reports from Washington.
In a 50-page study obtained by the Washington Post, less than half of water pollutant violators were fined, and when they were, the average punishment was $6,000. Some companies, free from government sanction, have been polluting waterways with toxic and biological waste for years. Eric Eckel, spokesman for American Rivers, says that
and what this report shows is that EPA isn't enforcing the law even where it does apply.
Officials from the EPA's Office of Enforcement and Compliance say that as a result of the study, state-by-state watch lists to enforce the Clean Water Act will be created for more aggressive monitoring of water treatment facilities. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Miranda Dunn.
For Free Speech Radio News at WBAI, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
The pressure is mounting in London for a full judicial inquiry into the use of intelligence information to justify the war against Iraq. This morning, the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament in London also demanded answers, this on the heels of their case seeking legal review of the legality of war without the clear mandate from the Security Council. Meanwhile, inside Iraq, U.S. troops detained two Iraqis in the town of Fallujah, west of Baghdad, in what the military describe as a patrol operation. Residents in Fallujah told Agence France-Presse that during the patrols, U.S. troops shot dead an Iraqi gun shop owner after mistaking him for an armed assailant as he repaired a Kalashnikov outside his store. This as there is growing criticism that the U.S. military is failing to disarm Iraqis who say they need weapons to defend themselves against rising crime and insecurity. Fariba Nawa has this report from Baghdad.
U.S. Army Sergeant Trevor Davis is tired and frustrated after hours of sitting in a sweltering Iraqi police station waiting for people to turn in their weapons. He has been doing the same thing every day since June 1st, when the U.S. military set up a program for Iraqis to voluntarily disarm.
So how many people actually come in a day on average to turn in their weapons?
Zero. Nobody's turned in a weapon.
Since you started?
Since I've started. Nobody's turned a weapon. People have been coming in just to register their weapons.
During Saddam Hussein's regime, Iraqis 26 or older could own a pistol or hunting rifle, but now looted and smuggled firearms such as AK-47s and grenades are at sale at the local market. Gunshots are heard every night echoing through Baghdad's polluted sky. The U.S.-led coalition stopped their weapons raids and issued an amnesty period from June 1st to the 14th for weapons owners to surrender or register their weapons with their local police. An average of six people a day, mostly merchants, come in to register, but few, if any, hand over their guns. They are permitted to possess 7.62mm firearms, but at registration time, they must sign a form denouncing Hussein's Ba'ath Party. Some Iraqis say they would have turned in their weapons if they received money in exchange, but not for free. Others say they will never surrender their arms to foreigners. One Iraqi man bought four machine guns and a pistol from the black market. He says until stability returns, his firearms will be with him.
Iraqis have a right to possess these weapons in order to defend themselves because Americans are not doing the job. And peace and security can only be achieved by establishing an Iraqi government.
After Saturday, the U.S.-led coalition will confiscate unregistered weapons at the checkpoints and market raids. At the crowded Friday market in New Baghdad, a Shiite neighborhood, customers can buy at a discount raid a sundry of looted merchandise taken from government ministries. Hidden in the midst sit a group of three men with plastic bags and carton boxes in front of them. Inside are ammunition for Kalashnikovs, each bullet for less than a nickel, a grenade for about $3.50, and a machine gun up for bargaining. One vendor explains why he's selling illegal weapons.
We don't have jobs. I worked in the oil ministry, and that man worked as a teacher, and the other man was also an oil ministry worker. We had jobs. Now we have nothing. It's dangerous, but Bush put us where we are.
The press is not welcome at this market. Some men gather around the vendors and argue with them to stop the interview and stop talking to the American media. another man plays with a grenade as if he's about to pull the pin. The 52 legal gun dealers in Baghdad are sitting at home because Americans have closed their shops and promised to reopen them when security returns. Mustafa Bierka, a 30-year-old gun shop owner, supports 9 family members. During Hossein's regime, he legally made $16 a day selling pistols and hunting rifles, but now his shop is empty. He has no legal income.
I'm outside the politics of it all, but I'm not happy that they closed my shop. But they're the responsible ones, and if they can bring security and I can reopen the shop, then I have no problem.
The burning question is how fast will security return to Baghdad, and how much longer can Bierka and dozens of others like him survive without an income? For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ferry Banoa in Baghdad.
On the heels of a joint attack by the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, Hamas, and the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade yesterday, which killed 5 Israeli soldiers, the industrial zone and border crossing near the Erez Junction were closed, barring some 14,000 Palestinians from getting to their work sites, while the IDF promised reprisals for the killings. This is the American media is reporting that Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has begun dismantling illegal Jewish settlements. They say he's keeping up Israel's end of the roadmap peace plan. Yet as Gilly Cray of the Arab-Jewish partnership Tayush tells us, Sharon is not the dove recent media reports paint him to be.
First of all, it's important to note that out of the 15 what are known as outposts, not settlements, but outposts in the occupied territories, out of the 15 that are being dismantled today, only 4 are actually occupied with people, which means that 11 are actually empty. There are only some caravans on top of hills, some infrastructure with no people living in them. These are places we know that people go to only over the weekend to spend some time, what they call enjoying their land, while, of course, harassing the Palestinian residents in the area. But these are not places where people actually live in. So this is the easy step into roadmap, if at all Sharon is planning on continuing with it. This is just an easy step to show the American administration that he's doing what he promised to do, but we know that this is virtual dismantling. It's not the real thing yet.
Is this somewhat of a turnaround, though, because Sharon has been very adamant that he will not dismantle settlements? And maybe you can talk about some of the other parts of the roadmap peace plan that Sharon has balked at implementing.
I have to say I'm very skeptic, and many people share that view with me, not only peace activists, but also political correspondents and journalists. The way we see it today is that Sean is working to please the American administration, and he only needs to stall until the Bush administration goes into their election year and forgets about the Middle East. So it's all about stalling for this time, and Sean is doing these things to show the Bush administration that he has opposition from the right wing, and the right wing settlers are out there. They held a big demonstration last week. They held a big press conference today in which they stated that they will oppose and they will refuse to be evicted from the settlements and the outposts. They did stress that they do not want to show any kind of violence towards soldiers. What they'll do is, after the dismantling, the morning after, they'll come and rebuild it. That is their plan. And they're working straight into Sharon's hands, because this is what he wants to show the American administration, that despite the opposition from the right and everything, he is a dove. But us real doves know that this is not the real thing. Closure is still happening in the occupied territories as we speak. There's only one day of easing of the closure during the Aqaba meetings, and since then the closure is back. the assassinations are back, and nothing has changed as far as the reality of the Palestinian people in the occupied territories.
So given that, then, do you think the attacks which happened yesterday, where we saw the three groups, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and the Al-Aqsa's Martyr Brigade, joining together to attack the Israeli military, is that a sign from the Palestinian people that they think Abu Mazen is selling them out in his talks with Ariel Sharon and President Bush?
I don't think so. I think that it is a sign of them wanting to be able and continue some kind of guerrilla fighting against the Israeli army, which is very different than fighting against Israeli civilians. I think it is a sign of them showing that they still have power. And I don't think it's a show of non-confidence in Abu Mazen. It's just a test on the, in the road towards showing full confidence in his leadership.
Jilly Ray of the Arab-Jewish partnership Tayush. Within the last few months, Canadian police and security officials have made a series of arrests of Muslim community members under what they call the, quote, security certificate. The security certificate allows the Canadian government to arrest, detain, and deport landed immigrants who are charged with being a national security threat. There is no chance of bail, detention can be indefinite, and neither the person detained under the security certificate nor their defence lawyer is allowed access to the evidence. And as Stefan Christoph reports from Montreal, the security certificate is being increasingly used to arrest, detain, and deport members of Muslim communities across Canada.
Adel Shakraoui, aged 30, an immigrant originally from Morocco and father of a young son, was recently nabbed in a police and security operation off the streets of Montreal. He is currently being held in detention under a so-called security certificate. Shakraoui is suspected of having links to members of Al-Qaeda. However, there has been no evidence presented by the Canadian government to prove the allegations. Such practices are allowed under Canada's post-September 11th security laws. The Justice for Adel Shakraoui campaign formed in Montreal in a matter of days after his abrupt arrest. The campaign demands a fair trial for Shakraoui and for the immediate end of the security certificate under which he is being held. Yahya Abdurrahman of the Justice for Adel Shakraoui Coalition.
Under the security certificate, somebody can be picked up by the CSIS, can be held without charge and have no access to the evidence against them, and to be deported to their country of origin. Security certificate, it's basically a direct attack upon the right of a person to know the charges that are against them and the right to defend himself against those charges. Security certificates seem to be singling out and targeting one community, that is the Arab and the Muslim community.
Since September 11th, the security certificate has been used almost exclusively against members of Arab and or Muslim communities in Canada. Immigrant and refugee rights groups are currently organizing under slogans like No One is Illegal and fighting for the end of the security certificate. I spoke with Salma Ahmad of the No One is Illegal campaign in Montreal.
We fight for the rights of migrants, immigrants, refugees, and this is one case where an immigrant, his basic rights to know what evidence is presented against him, his basic rights of innocence until proven guilty have been completely denied. People are scared. People are scared of terrorism. They're using the whole terrorism excuse to deny immigrants their basic rights.
Algerian refugee Mohamed Harket was also arrested under the same security certificate. He has been detained without trial since late 2002. Harket, like Shakraoui, is also facing deportation from Canada without any public evidence as to his guilt. I spoke with Sophie Harket, the wife of Mohamed Harket.
Basically, with a security certificate, is they're entitled to arrest you without telling you why you're being arrested and without showing you any of the evidence. This is an unfair treatment. It goes against all human rights. My husband is in solitary confinement. So one day in solitary confinement equals 3 days of ordinary jail. And most people that are finding the certificate are in the same position. They're under solitary confinement. The government is putting us through hell, basically.
The security certificate represents an unprecedented assault on the rights of immigrants and refugees in Canada post-September 11th. Many legal observers have called the increased use of the security certificate nothing short of medieval justice. Communities here in Montreal are currently organizing protests, direct actions, and popular education efforts to fight for an end of the security certificate. This is Stefan Christophe reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Montreal.
Work was halted recently on a strip mine in eastern Arizona as the state of New Mexico denied permission for the Arizona-based Salt River Project utility company to use water from a threatened aquifer near the proposed mine. Meanwhile, the National Trust for Historic Preservation listed Arizona's Zuni Salt Lake as one of America's 11 most endangered places of 2003. The Zuni Salt Lake may also be threatened by the mine, according to a coalition of Native American environmental activists. Evan Davis has this report.
Native Americans and environmental activists in Arizona's Central Valley region are protesting a proposed strip mining project which they claim will disrupt thousands of ancestral burial sites and destroy the Zuni Salt Lake, which is sacred to the people of the First Nations throughout the Southwest.
What they are looking for is to mine coal, strip mine of coal, in the vicinity of the Zuni Salt Lake, which requires the pumping of water from the aquifer for a slurry line.
Tupac Enrique Acosta, spokesperson for the Zuni Salt Lake Coalition, spoke at a recent 24-hour vigil at the headquarters of the Salt River Project, the public-private partnership utility company which holds the permits for the 18,000-acre Fence Lake coal mine.
So with strip mine, they scrape the top layers of the earth off to get to the coal underneath, and all of this is going to be in the area of the is going to involve the desecration of 55,000 minimally identified human remains that are in that sanctuary zone. The Zunis, with the support of the other Southwest tribes and even ecumenical groups like from Christian denominations in New Mexico, fought the mine successfully for 10 years. But then, end of last season, the Bush administration signed the lease to allow the company to go forward.
The Zuni Salt Lake Coalition, which includes nearly 20 tribal councils, indigenous rights groups, and local chapters of the Women's International League of Peace and Freedom and the Sierra Club, says the mine also threatens the vital aquifer that serves both the Greater Phoenix area and many surrounding tribal lands.
My name is Gustavo Gutierrez. I'm from Opata Nation. One of the things that really concerns us a lot is the water issue. As you know, we're in a very delicate position. A lot of the water is being diverted, and for some reason they don't seem to realize that if they keep on growing and growing, that somebody's going to pay the consequences. But here in this area, people want to make a replica of back east. But you can't do that. And like, for instance, with the Hopis, their sacred springs are now getting pretty well dried up because of the coal mine.
Scott Harrelson, spokesperson for the Salt River Project, said the company has complied with all federal guidelines that apply to archaeological and environmental regulations and cites the growing demand for utilities in the Greater Phoenix area and the company's obligations to its customers and shareholders as the primary reasons for pursuing this new mine.
The Salt River Project has a defined service territory that we provide electricity and water to. There are still open, unurbanized, still rural parts of our service territory that have yet to be developed. The permits that we have obtained ensure the safety of Zuni Salt Lake, and it also ensures, as well as SRP's heritage as a public power utility in the state of Arizona.
Cal Sisawa, coalition organizer and member of the Zuni Tribal Council.
SRP has definitely been in the driver's seat of this whole issue and have been able to manipulate all the federal and state processes and have done a major lobbying effort in Congress and other forces, and especially we suspect was very influential in helping looking at this administrative's accelerated energy domestic energy development policies. And once the Bush administration came in, it pretty well greased the wheel for SRP to push their development of the Zuni Salt Fence Lake full swing.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Evan Davis in Phoenix, Arizona.
Business magazines rate Anniston, Alabama, as one of the worst places to live in America. In the 1920s, Monsanto made the city the world's largest producer of PCBs, and then in the 1930s, the Army arrived, bringing with it the Chemical Weapons Corps. Landfills now hold a fetid stew of half a century of PCB wastes, and Anniston stores close to 10% of the nation's aging, leaky chemical weapons stockpile. And now the Army wants to burn hundreds of thousands of chemical weapons in a billion-dollar incinerator beginning as early as the 1st of July. Citizens groups have sued both the Army and Monsanto looking for relief. And as Jack Hickey reports, residents of Anniston say this legacy of military and commercial pollution typify a toxic pattern of life in the southeast.
Mike Abrams is one of the Army's information officers in Anniston.
We have GB nerve agent, we have VX nerve agent, and we have mustard agent in hundreds of thousands of different weapons. The presence of those weapons in storage present a bit of a risk to this community. We want to eliminate that risk.
Abrams admits past sins of approach and attitude on the military's part. Today, though, at a cost of $1 billion, the Army has built a nerve gas incinerator that will spend another $15 to $25 billion to get rid of the weapons stored here. The Army contends that this facility exists solely to promote the safety and well-being of Anniston. Not everyone agrees. Rufus Kinney, a professor at nearby Jacksonville State University, forms citizens concerned with chemical weapons and offers an orientation to what is happening.
Anniston is the most PCB-polluted community in America, maybe in the world, and it is what I call a human sacrifice zone. This community is not by history or this region accustomed to questioning the status quo, questioning the government, questioning the Army. This is one little branch of the Army called the Program Manager for Chemical Demilitarization, and it is totally abused its position. By the way, these things only end up in the places where you have large populations of minorities and large populations of working class whites. And this relates to what we call environmental justice. Environmental justice is the basic principle that all people, regardless of race or income, have an equal right to clean air, clean water, and clean food.
A prime source of Anniston's background toxicity has been Monsanto's PCB factory. Unknown quantities of buried waste hidden on company property continue to foul the soil, air, and water on a daily basis. David Baker formed Community Against Pollution to fight Monsanto for very personal reasons.
I started this out. My brother died in 1970, 71. He was 16 years old. He had a tumor of the brain, cancer of the lung, and hardened the arteries of the heart. He never smoked a cigarette. He never got a chance to enjoy life. And that's why I take this commitment so serious, because of him and because of all the other children that is now coming up behind them. We have children here that's been born with two brains. We have young ladies with uterus cancer at the age of 10. Children that can't read and write. This is a horror of horrors.
Community Against Pollution has served over 30,000 clients since 1993. It helped to formulate the class action lawsuits involving 17,000 plaintiffs, led by Johnny Cochran and others. Most of these complaints, Monsanto will settle. One group of property owners already receiving around $50 million. Compared with Monsanto, Baker thinks he can trust the military. He is ready for the incinerator to do its job.
If they're going to light the incinerator, they need to go ahead and do what they got to do, and let's get this stuff on. We want to get rid of the most dangerous stuff as soon as possible and as safe as possible. They, I think, would not put themselves in jeopardy.
Rufus Kinney offers a cautionary perspective here.
The reason they're cooperating with us now is because the people demanded it.
Shirley Baker, David's wife, is a partner in organizing against Monsanto. She mainly agrees with her husband, although she recognizes the similar burdens that both industrial and military effluent impose on this community.
This city is just a toxic gumbo. There's the incinerator that is about to dump things back out on us that we already have. Dioxins, furans, PCBs, everything is going to be dumped back out on us. At least the Army, at some point in time, they will let you know what kind of what's going on. But Monsanto, for the last 40 to 50 years, has hid. It's just been years, it's been decades of deception.
From Anniston, Alabama, this is Jack Hickey for Free Speech Radio News.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.